Pegos.
Okay, welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian Wimp and William Tincup coming to you live with the little Maroon 5. Get rolling on a Monday morning. Gotta like that. William, it's funny because I forgot that I queued that up, and that was like the long play version. That would have cut 3-4 minutes into the show there. Funny how you remember things, right? It's like, oh, hey, that's cool music. Oh, hey, that's long music, right? Oh, my gosh. So, speaking of the Super Bowl, worst segue ever. What'd you think of last night's game, William?
You know, I picked the winner. So, of course, it makes me look really, really smart because early on the playoffs, I took a wild card, and I liken it to the Jerome Bettis situation years ago where he kind of went out on top, and it was a storyline. And so I kind of looked at the Ray Lewis deal. I said, you know what, if anything's going to happen, this is the year. All these teams are ish good, and some are hotter than others. And so I picked the Ravens, but really I just wanted a good game. And before the power went out, it really wasn't that great of a game. Pretty much all the breaks had gone the Ravens' way. And I think San Francisco was the better team. The San Francisco all of a sudden scored a bunch and kind of got it back really, really close. So it ended up being a really compelling Super Bowl. So I you know, if San Francisco were to have won last night, I would have been just as happy. So what did you think?
You definitely, and I heard you say it early, so you picked it. You were way ahead of the curve on kind of your thoughts around the Ravens kind of maybe sneaking into the final. They did, and you know, I'm a Niners fan. Kind of back on the bandwagon now after a big drought. And it was good. You know, I was glad they showed up. It was one of those things that I think that you know, it's been an interesting year, and I think that was a great finality. I mean, the finality of just a closing of a chapter, and you know, at the same time on the Niners side. And, you know, on the Ravens side, you got a lot of new talent coming in that I think are going to be around for a long time, to include coaching. I mean, you got two pretty stand-up guys and the organizations as a whole, you know, coaching-wise. You know, that kind of made for kind of a good feel-good story. So,
yeah.
But, it was all right. It was one of those things. I wasn't thrilled. I wish the Niners would have came on top. But it was an exciting game right to the very end. So people got their money's worth, you know, all the way through. So, but, well, let's talk a little inspiration and creative today. Let's get to our guest. I would love to introduce, first time on the show, Michael Bungay Sanier. Probably didn't even get close on that, but I tried my best, Michael. So,
please,
if you would, welcome. Welcome to Drive Through HR family.
Hey, look, it's really nice to be here. You know, I've been a long-time listener and a fan, so it's great to be on the show. I appreciate your generous welcome.
Well, definitely. If you could, go ahead and introduce yourself, and then we'll roll into what's top of mind with you.
Sure. Well, obviously, because we're on radio, I can tell people that I'm a tall, dark, handsome man, but which is true. But here's what they're probably more interested in. I run a small company called Box of Crayons. We say that our mission is to help people and organizations do less good work and more great work. So I've written a couple of books, probably the most popular of which is called Do More Great Work, Stop the Busy Work and Start the Work That Matters. And I am based in Toronto, Canada, although I got there via time in Boston, time in London and other places in the UK, and I'm originally from Australia. So I watched the Super Bowl last night without really understanding much of what I was seeing, but still.
Nice. Well, Michael, this is William. What's keeping you up at night these days? What's top of mind for you in 2013?
Well, I tell you, it's actually a perfect segue. This is a good segue to the Super Bowl piece, which is, you know, one of the great stories from the Super Bowl was about the two coaches and the fact that they were brothers and they were kind of actually pleasant to each other rather than the usual old rivalry. And here's what's keeping me awake. Here's what I fret about is why are our managers in our organizations still stuck in controlling command ways of management rather than using more coaching skills in the way that they engage the people, inspire the people, focus the folks around them? Really, there's so much evidence to say that adding coaching to your repertoire as a manager can really have an impact on productivity, on engagement, on motivation, on the bottom line. And yet we're stuck in very old patterns around, let me tell you what to do. That's what's bugging me. That's what's keeping me up at night.
What's the single biggest barrier to that from your perspective? Why don't we see more of that in today's workplace?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've done research and I've read research on this, and when you ask people, their instinct is to say, well, you know, it's people just go, coaching's this kind of pastel, fuzzy, Muzak type HR thing. So maybe that's it. Maybe they just don't want to get into the soft skill stuff. Or maybe they go, you know, perhaps the thing is I don't have the skills, I don't have the training to be more coach-like. Maybe that's the problem. But what the research tells us is that the key barrier to why managers don't coach as much as they might is a lack of time. They, you know, we're all in this place of overwhelm, too much going on, too many reporting relationships, too much stuff coming down the pike at us. And we all go, look, even if I wanted to, even if I knew how to do this, even if I actually was committed to coaching, the fact that I feel so busy, I feel so overwhelmed, that's the single biggest barrier that research tells us is getting in the way.
So if lack of time is, and I agree, I think actually the time management in general holds most of us back, let's just say, but let's talk about the recruiters and HR in particular. How do we teach time management? Do we have to, like in your kind of in your array, do you think we need to go back into kind of elementary school, middle school, high school, college, like right when people get into the field, we teach them time management? How do we fix that so that we can ultimately fix some of these other things?
Let me tell you, if I had the answer to how to fix time management, I would be a wealthy man and I'd be spending my time on an island somewhere drinking a martini and feeling smug. So, you know, it's tricky and it's only getting harder. You know, 10 years ago, I think, there was an article in the Harvard Business Review called Beware the Busy Manager. And this was a cross-country, cross-sector piece of research. And they found that only 10% of managers actually had the combination of energy and focus that allowed them to stay targeted on the work that really matters and do a better job at managing all the other stuff. And, you know, 10 years ago, that's not when email and technology and all of these things that are also chipping away at our ability to stay focused really were in their infancy. So that number has got to have shrunk rather than got any better. So I'm with, you know, there's a very big industry around time management, but I'm not sure it's that effective in terms of what it preaches. You know, I know David Allen, and I know he's getting things done. People, I think there's some good tactics there. But I like the thinking of people like Tony Schwartz. You may know his book from The Way We're Working Isn't Working, where he says, look, you can't manage time. Time happens regardless. But what you can do is manage your energy and manage your focus. So I think part of what's most interesting here is less about how do I manage time, but more about understanding that your attention is a precious commodity, and having to think about, so how do I manage my attention? How do I manage my distraction to have more impact in the work that I do?
Awesome. You've obviously traveled and lived all over the globe. I want to get your take on the difference between good work and great work. Like, what's the perspective, you know, of a global traveler, if you will?
Right.
What, you know, how do you see those things in different places that you have both lived and traveled?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. You know, I think one of the reasons people like this model that I present around everything you do falls into one of three buckets. It's either bad work, good work, or great work. It's a model, And you know the saying, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So I think this is a wrong but useful model. And what I'd say is that there's a certain universality to that, particularly when you define it in certain ways. So here's how I would define those three categories really quickly. Bad work. Bad work is bureaucracy, waste of time. You know, it's that stuff that you look at it and you go, this is sucking my life dry. This is crushing my spirit. And this is my one and precious life. And somehow I'm doing this. I'm at this meeting or filling out that form or stuck in that process. That's bad work. And, you know, universal, at least in all the places I've ever spoken at or gone to, people go, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've never had anybody go, yeah, I don't understand that definition. What is that? So if that's bad work. Good work is effectively your job description. So by good work, we're talking about work that is important. It's productive, it's efficient, it's focused, it's, to use David Allen's words, it's getting things done. And our organizations are set up to deliver good work. You know, it's what your boss wants you to do and what your boss's boss wants you to do. So it plays an important role because, you know, in many ways, organizations, whether they're public or private sector, they're all about what's the product, what's the service that we can get out there efficiently in a focused way that delivers to what people need and kind of keeps you going. But the challenge with good work, William, is that it is, well, two things, I guess. One is it keeps you stuck in a bit of a comfortable rut. So even though you're busy and even if you may be feeling overwhelmed and stressed, you know when you're doing good work, you're really not pushing yourself, you're really not stretching towards your potential, you're really not having the impact you might. And one of the great ways of testing that is the Friday afternoon test. So Friday afternoon, you're holding a glass of wine or a beer or something, you're thinking about the week that has just passed, you know you've been working hard, you've put in your 40 or 50 or maybe 60 hours of work, and you think to yourself, you can't remember a damn thing you did, right? And you're thinking, that's a lot of time not to be able to kind of pinpoint, 50, 60 hours. But what happens is your brain is going, look, this is good work. It's familiar. We know how to do it. We've just shoveled that into our unconscious mind rather than kept it present in our prefrontal cortex, our conscious mind. So that's good work. Important, but it tends to suck up our time. It's like a black hole. It's got a real gravity to it that kind of pulls us into it. And then we've got great work. So great work, it's the work that makes a difference. It's the work that has meaning. It's the work we care about. It's the work we kind of signed up to do in the first place. And we've all got many of us have a good memory of a time when we've done great work, when we've stretched and when we've grown to push ourselves around that. But the challenge is, and the hunger that I think people have is, look, I can't replace everything I do with great work. That's actually not sustainable. But what I'd love to do is get a little more great work and a little less of all the other stuff happening in my life. And how do I kind of balance the scales in a slightly different way so I've got much more of that great work that means that when I'm going into work, I'm like, let me get in there because I'm onto something cool at the moment. William, does that all make sense?
No, it absolutely does. Thank you very much. You've heard the cliche that many times probably that, you know, people don't quit companies, they quit bad managers. What's your take on bad managers? What can we do about them, or what's your treatment of bad managers, if you will?
Gosh, you know, I mean, I've got opinions on that, and, you know, part of them are formed by having suffered my own bad managers in my time. So, you know, I can roll up my sleeves and show you my scars from my own bad managers. So, you know, I think there's a couple of things to be thinking about. I think one of them is, and I remember Tom Peters talking about this years ago, one of them is to say, look, I'm with this bad manager, and the first thing is I have a choice, which is am I actively seeking to leave this bad manager, or am I choosing to stick with it and tolerate it? And for any number of reasons, you may choose one or other of those two options. You know, the easy and perhaps naive thing to say is, look, just leave your bad manager, quit the job or find another role or whatever it is and get out from that person. But obviously that's not a realistic thing for a lot of people a lot of time. So if you have the option, one might be to go, okay, how do I find an alternative? But let's say you're stuck with your bad manager, okay? So part of it, I think, is around building resilience around this and building and effectively managing your self-esteem and effectively your morale as you work with this bad manager. So I think there are a few things to go on. One is understanding that it's not just about them, it's about you and them as a system together. So part of the question to be asking is, in what way are you contributing to this dynamic? What's your role in this dynamic? So part of it is to take some responsibility yourself around this. Another piece, and this is what I think Tom Peters said brilliantly, is, look, your bad manager is a brilliant opportunity to learn, A, how to manage being managed poorly, so developing strategies and tactics around that. Secondly, to understand what you should not be doing when you are managing people as well, because, you know, for everybody who's had a bad manager, you've probably been a bad manager to somebody somewhere along the line. I know I certainly have. So I think that's part of it as well. And, you know, the key thing to be thinking about, I think, in terms of resilience around this, William and Brian, are two things. One is setting some short-term and longer-term goals about how you manage this, and finding support outside that relationship with the one-to-one manager, whether that's, you know, with mates down the pub, you know, having a drink and just having a chance to debrief around it, whether it's finding different alliances within the organization, whether it's finding a mentor somewhere else, whether it's finding a way to kind of circumnavigate that manager as best you can. You know, there's no silver bullet to any of this, but I think the key thing around it is to not lose your sense of, I am an active participant in this relationship. What choices am I going to make to try and manage this? Rather than resigning yourself to victimhood, which is miserable for everybody involved.
Well, perfect. This is Brian. We'll do a quick reset. Everybody listening to Drive Through HR, Brian and William on with Michael. Michael, if you would, I've got a question that we always like to put out to probably more than not to everybody, just to get their take on it. So,
yeah.
Based kind of on our conversation thus far, how did generations kind of weave their way into the whole generational question and how it affects it? How does that weave its way into everything that we've talked about thus far?
You know, I can't claim to have any specific expertise on this. Now, you know, that's never stopped me having an opinion on it, so let me have an opinion anyway, but know that it comes from, you know, not a ream of data behind me explaining it. My basic take on it is this, that the generations are more similar than they are different. And I think that it can be too easy to go, okay, so you've got this type of generation, they tend to buckle down, work hard, be responsible, and then you've got our feckless youth who, you know, want to become VPs immediately and don't really want to do any work, and they buck authority and they're irresponsible, all of that sort of stuff, which is, you know, the cliche of how these things are falling out. And, you know, I've seen some research that says, look, in many ways, that younger generation is more focused, more ambitious, more disciplined than you could say that older generation that perhaps is a little more stuck in the groove of doing good work. But when it comes down to it for me, Brian, I would basically say, look, in the end, everybody has a similar hunger for impact. I think a similar hunger for trying to find some of the work that matters and makes a difference. I think there's always a bell curve about the levels of engagement that you would have in a group, but I don't think that it correlates to age and what generation band you fall into. So for me, I would say, and I come at it particularly with a passion around coaching, I would say that the people who I've seen manage through coaching can be, you know, is as powerful for somebody who is 60 as it is for somebody who's 40, as it is for somebody who's 20, because it's about giving people responsibility to make choices and figure stuff out for themselves, and it's about helping people expand and fulfill their own potential, and that is a hunger that stretches across all generations.
Well, tangential to what Brian was talking about, what you've just answered, is the concept of loyalty. And how we all define loyalty, you know, I think we can probably remember a time when companies were loyal to us and we were loyal to companies, and that's changed, however, and why, and all the other stuff aside. I know you probably get this in the work that you do. The people across the table are like, why coach? Why invest? Why do all these things? How do you...
Yep.
How do you navigate them around either the concept of loyalty or even why to invest in these types of programs?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that that lack of loyalty, or to frame it another way, that entrepreneurial hunger is more prevalent certainly than it was, 10 years or 20 years ago. I remember when Dan Pink's first book came out and feeling and getting sort of like, oh, this feels so radical about this rise of the freelance and the independent and the, I'm in control of my own career piece. And now, of course, it doesn't feel radical at all. It just feels like that's normal. That's what it is now. I think that, first of all, if engagement and if motivation and if loyalty is part of what you are hungry for, then things like coaching is one way to give people a sense of connection and a sense of this is the value I add as a manager, as a part of an organization that may keep you working longer. Daniel Goleman some years ago wrote a book, an article called Leadership That Gets Results. And it said basically, look, 6 hours of leadership. Typical leaders use 2, maybe 3. Really great leaders know when to use all 6. Coaching was the least used of those leadership styles, even though it could see it had the strongest correlation with things like employee engagement. It was, I think, second or third in terms of impacting bottom line as well. So it can really make a big difference around that. So I would say that, first of all, there's good evidence for things like in coaching around this isn't just a touchy-feely hug thing. This is a business decision to have people more focused, more engaged, spending more time working on the stuff that really matters. And secondly, I think that there's a way of saying doing things like coaching is actually a way of generating and building greater loyalty than would be there otherwise.
Nice. When I ask a question about the military, from the perspective of in the military, you have this concept of the clear intent, where all the way at the very top, they clearly communicate what the goal of the mission is, et cetera. Mm. And so if anybody's off kind of off by themselves, they still know what the mission is. Are military leaders, are they better apt for private enterprise than they were years ago? Like, are they kind of born and they're great inside of a military system, and then they kind of flounder when they go to private enterprise? Or what's been your experience with that particular type of leadership model?
Well, I think, it's one of those things around organizational fit. I'm based in Canada, so I kind of look down. I don't literally look down, but I look across the border to the U.S. And so, for instance, you see various organizations making commitments to bring veterans on as part of the work they do. I mean, I just did a little work with GE, and part of what they were like, we're going to take on X thousand veterans every year as part of our commitment to supporting our armed forces. So my guess is that there are a bunch of organizations where that military style doesn't work, and there are a bunch of organizations where it does. And, of course, there is no military style. There are, there's a guy I know who's a 20-year veteran of the Australian Navy. And so you'd think he would have absolutely drunk the Kool-Aid, and he looks like he's drunk the Kool-Aid. He's got the short haircut and the kind of military posture. And he's one of the most flexible, creative leaders that I know. In one of my other clients, there's a bunch of people who are ex-Marine there. And I would say you have a spectrum there of people who are pretty rigid and pretty, like, this is the way to do it, and other people who are extremely open to what you'd call you could classify as a fairly non-military way of leadership, which is, more coach-like rather than command and control. So, this is a kind of wafty answer, William going, yeah, maybe, yes and yet no. So I don't know, but I think there's so much you look at the military leadership where you go, look, there's a ton of stuff that the military do that is absolutely innovative and important and structured in terms of leadership. Everything from that kind of line of sight, know your mission and get that communicated, to the after-action review where you actually have the discipline to stop and go, what happened? What are we learning? in an ennobling culture, what will we do next time differently that actually builds on the learning? So there's brilliant things that happen with the leadership, and I'm absolutely sure that there's a bunch of people who show up and who go, look, I need structure and discipline, and I don't work well without it.
Hey, William, just a comment on that. I think with how the military, you know, how a military type structure works really well, but and also falls apart, is that the mission is very common, right? You have common language, you have, you know, kind of the like-minded. We've all been trained. Here's kind of the standard operating procedure. SOP is a big thing, and we understand the mission. And the vision basically is just completely stripped away. You become a little less visionless when you go through basic training. They start all the teardown to break you up to where the mission is critical, and we've got to get in line on what the mission is as a team, not as individuals. And that's where I see, you know, probably some of the most impactful leaders out there is they're able to kind of get the best of all of that. And, you know, that's where, you know, kind of the magic happens, because they can pull together everybody on, like, here are the various missions. But ultimately, it overarches with a vision that people are like, you know, I want to do whatever it takes to get any mission accomplished, because I believe in the vision, the visionary, you know, whatever, if that, whether that's product, purpose, place, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, let me get both of you. Oh, go ahead, Michael.
Well, I know we're close to being done, but I just have read a book that I think might be interesting around this. It's called The Antidote. It's by a British journalist based in New York. I can't remember his name. Oliver somebody, I think. And he talked about the dark side of goals, how that goals can be extremely useful, and that's that whole mission and vision piece. But they can also become destructive when the goal overrides everything else. And the example he gives us is climbing Everest, and the numerous times where there have been mass fatalities on Everest because the goal, get to the top of the mountain, absolutely trumped sensibleness around, we turn back because we're not going to get to the top of the mountain without a bunch of people dying. So I think it's that part of it's that balance that you want to strike. What comes with clarity is an inability sometimes to deal with ambiguity, and the courage to go against the clarity of this is absolutely what the answer is. That make sense?
Absolutely. I think Brian has his mic on mute. We have just about 2 minutes left, Michael. Where are you going to go this year? Are you going to attending any conferences, or do you have a book coming out? And the last thing is, before we close out, definitely need to make sure of how folks can reach you. So.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking. Thank you, William. So I've got a book. In fact, it's just being sold today. My agent's negotiating with the publisher today around it. The working title is going to be called The Time-Crunched Manager, and I hope it'll be out the final quarter of this year. So The Time-Crunched Manager, Work Less Hard, Have More Impact. And, you know, if people are interested in that at all, a great starting point is actually on LinkedIn. There is a group that I started called The Time-Crunched Manager, where it's not a sales page. It's a community of 1,000 or so people who are sharing strategies to stay focused, make an impact, do more great work. So that's certainly one place, LinkedIn, The Time-Crunched Manager. And then on my website, boxofcrayons.biz, B-I-Z, there's a ton of free stuff people can download, from e-courses to animated movies to, I have about 200 podcast interviews I've done as well. So if you're looking to supplement drive-through HR, then there may be something interesting there for people as well. So people are welcome to come in and pillage on the website.
Fantastic. Michael, thank you so much for coming on with us. Great conversation. Hopefully we can good luck with the book, by the way. That's fantastic. People, check out the website. I've been on there. Spent a little time this morning. Very, very interesting things. Pillage away. Folks, we're out of here. Happy Monday. Enjoy. Make the best of it. Align with the good work that's happening today.